Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Yeah, I had first had the privilege of meeting Muhammad last May when he spoke at the Asia Society panel organized by Andy and me on the global investment environment. He was joined on the panel by various luminaries of the investment world, but he soon distinguished himself as one of the most thoughtful and experienced among an array of stars. I only wish I had paid more attention to what he was saying then. I'm not going to go through, you know, Muhammad's resume for you. You've already got that. But let me just pass on to you a few of the accolades that have been thrown his way recently. Fareed Zakaria says of Muhammad, he is a rare creature, a skillful participant in financial markets who is also a brilliant analyst of them. When Muhammad's book won the Financial Times and Goldman Sachs Business Book for the Year Award this last September, the citation read in part, "A most compelling and enjoyable insight into modern business news." And Alan Greenspan says of our speaker, he is one of the most gifted and successful risk management practitioners in the world. He combines an academic's insight into advanced risk analysis with a portfolio manager's grasp of real-world economics. But at the same time, you need to put Muhammad's company, PIMCO, in perspective to understand the impact of what he is doing and what he is doing with his company. Fortune, in its February 20 issue, had a few comments that I thought I would pass on that kind of frames where we are with PIMCO and what Muhammad is doing and the impact that he and his company are having on our current financial situation. PIMCO is much more than just a big bond house. It has become the U.S. government's partner in reviving the credit markets. It goes on to say that PIMCO is serving as a buyer of last resort for hedge funds and others seeking to sell bonds to raise cash. PIMCO also will be among the few institutional investors able to soak up the coming onslaught of treasuries as well as mortgage paper backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and municipal bonds. Finally, PIMCO has become essential to the functioning of the credit markets and the revival of our economy. That's a heavy burden. But we know it's in good hands, and so therefore, let's get on to the speaker. Let's not hear any more from me. Let me welcome both Muhammad and David, and thank you both for being part of our forum.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, good morning. Let me say up front that it's a huge pleasure, it's an honor for me to be here. I'd like to thank the Library Foundation for inviting me. I'd like to thank Andy Knox and Tom for convincing me to be here. I am a nervous wreck. I don't enjoy doing these things, but they were persistent, and I'm glad they were, so thank you very much. I'm going to say a few comments before I sit down and get grilled by David, who's standing there because he doesn't want to divert attention from me. So he's being very kind. And let me tell you one thing that Tom didn't say in his introduction. There is a term that has stuck with me since I was about 12. And since I was about 12, my first attempt at a girlfriend said this to me and it had stuck, is, "You're a nice guy, but." And the but is you're boring and unimaginative, okay? And I say this because if my wife were here, which unfortunately she cannot be, but if she were here, she will tell you that about a year and a half ago, I started coming home almost every day, and saying to her, "You won't believe what happened today in markets," or "You won't believe what happened today in the global economy." And she would humor me, she would listen to me, and think, "He really is boring. He keeps on repeating this thing." And change the subject. And we went through a period where I woke her up at 2:30 in the morning as I was going to work. And I said to her, "Jamie, get up, put on CNBC. Today is going to be a day that we're going to talk about for the rest of our lives." and she looked at me and smiled and went straight back to sleep. 2 days later, I called her. I said, Jamie, go to the ATM and take cash out. And she said, why? I said, because I don't know whether the banks are going to open tomorrow. Now, the situation is completely reversed. Now that the financial crisis has hit Main Street, she's the one who asks me every day when I get home, what happened today? Okay, and not only that, but all my in-laws ask me that question too. Okay, and I find myself not wanting to talk about it anymore. Right, and the reason why I'm starting that way is just to convey to you that we are living through not a crisis within the global system, but a crisis of the global system. That is a very important distinction. Because the minute you have a crisis of the system, as opposed to within the system, the circuit breakers do not work. Circuit breakers are not made to be triggered when the whole system is in crisis. They're made to be triggered when elements of the system is in crisis. Which means that anybody who gets up and says to you with any degree of confidence, the bottom for the economy is this quarter, the bottom for the market is that quarter, that person is not being intellectually honest. The reality is we do not know. The reality is there is no reset button. It's not as if you drop your phone and you just reset it. We are in what economists call a multiple equilibrium, where the crisis will continue to morph. So what I'd like to do in my introductory remarks is just three things. One is convey to you what is driving this. Two is tell you what to look for to know whether we are reaching some sort of turning point. And three, leave you with the notion that every single person, whether you're an individual, a company, a foundation, a government, has to navigate both the journey and the destination. We are on a very bumpy journey to a new destination. And everybody has to ask, what are my journey strategies and what are my destination strategies? The reason we're here is complex, but basically boils down to three issues. We had a number of long-standing weaknesses, structural weaknesses. If you go back, many people have been writing about the global imbalances, about this notion that the poor were lending to the rich. It was unsustainable. People knew that. Many people were talking about the failures of risk management. But like anything that's important but not urgent, the tendency is not to do anything about it. So these structural weaknesses, while well identified, were allowed to persist. The second, as important, is the world had a massive innovation, a massive financial innovation. It was called structured finance, the ability to take an activity and split it up into multiple activities, rebundle them, and change the characteristic of the activity. It's actually a very efficient innovation. But remember what happens with innovations in history. Human nature is to overproduce and overconsume an innovation before we understand it. We fall in love with what an innovation asks us to do, allows us to do. But we do not ask the question, are we able to sustain it? And most innovation end in tears in the first round. People actually lose money on most innovation in the first round. Not all, but most. And the third issue is that there was a feeling that it doesn't matter because ultimately we can control the process. There wasn't enough recognition, and I talk about it in the book, the difference between noise and signals. There wasn't enough understanding that there were signals being sent out that required the public and the private infrastructure to catch up. So when you have these three issues, it is inevitable that you will have market accidents. It is inevitable that you will have policy mistakes. That is the world we're living in today. Second issue is how do we recognize that things are going to change? At PIMCO, we tend to look for simple frameworks. Simple frameworks are very powerful because you don't get diverted by too much complexity. So if you can get to a simple framework, your life gets a lot easier. And that's why we tend to use simple examples, etc. The simple framework is you have four massive vacuums right now sucking oxygen out of this room, all operating at the same time. And when you have that happening, the question is first, not only how does the weak react, but how does the strong react? Everybody's going to feel the oxygen getting sucked out. So there are no sectors that are immune to what's going on, whether you're profitable or whether you're loss-making, okay, whether you're in the United States or whether you're in China, everybody will feel this oxygen effect being sucked out. And secondly, it doesn't stop till a new machine comes in to put new oxygen in. So what are the four elements? There are four sectors that are now all shrinking at the same time. We know about them, we read about them every day, David writes about them. The first one is housing. Housing turned in the summer of 06. It's still on the way down. The second is finance. The banks started turning in the summer of 07. The third is the U.S. consumer. Because of pressure from unemployment, wealth destruction, he or she started turning, quote unquote, in the summer of 08. And then after the failure of Lehman Brothers, which truly made a U.S.-centric disease a global disease, the rest of the world started turning. These are four massive sectors, all looking to delever. The result is you can't do it all at the same time, and you get these negative loopback effects that make it so critical. So you need a new balance sheet. You need a new source of oxygen to come in. And of course, there's only one source. You may like it, you may not like it, which is the government. And that's why we read about fiscal stimulus packages. That's why we read about housing programs. That's why we read about banks. And you should feel sorry for the policymaker. I would hate to be a policymaker right now. If you're a policymaker, you're flying a plane with instruments that don't tell you everything, with engines that are stalling, and with a co-pilot that's arguing with you, which is Congress. Do you really want to be the policymaker? Do you really think, okay, so we should... So this leads me to the third issue, which is ultimately, what does it mean? Let me give you, it's not often in our business that I can tell you this is unambiguous. So I'm going to tell you this is unambiguous. It is unambiguous that we are going to continue to see unemployment going up, that we're going to continue to see, unfortunately, production going down. These are all short-term effects. 09 is baked in. There's very little that the policymakers can do right now. More critically, and I was telling David that I look at my daughter every day and I say, wow, what world are we leaving you? And she's 5.5 years old. It is unambiguous that we are changing the structure of our world in the following ways. First, the next few years, and if you put a gun to my head, what do you mean by few? I'll tell you at least 5 years, is going to see a very dramatic shift between the private sector and the government. The government will be a much bigger owner and controller of the modes of production, not because it wants to, but because the alternative is worse. That has tremendous implication for the long-term growth potential of this economy, has potential implication for exit mechanisms that no one is quite sure of. But that's the reality. The second unambiguous reality is that we are seeing a massive consolidation of Wall Street. Wall Street is being de-risked. For those of you who play Monopoly, which I'm teaching my daughter because chess is proving to be too hard, but those of you who play Monopoly will remember the very expensive properties on the Monopoly board, the dark blue and dark green. Very expensive to buy, but once you buy, you can build hotels and houses, and you can basically collect a lot of money. That's what the banking system used to be like. That's what Wall Street used to be like. No more. The banks are now being turned into utilities. You remember the utilities on the Monopoly board? Very cheap to buy. You can't build anything on it, i.e. you can't lever it very much. And you can make a living, but it's going to be nothing compared to what you used to make. The consequences for society of suddenly de-risking and de-levering Wall Street are very large. You're going to cause a number of other consolidations across the economy that are going to play out. The last thing we're changing is the attitude of people. We are going from what I call an age of entitlement, where the average person felt entitled to consume today on the basis of income that was uncertain in the future, to an age of thrift, where the destruction is so large that people are going to become very cautious. In fact, one of the things we're doing at PIMCO today is to play defense in order to be able to play offense tomorrow. Not because we have to play defense, but we recognize that the world is changing so much. Which leaves me with my final comment that everybody out there in society has to ask the question, do I have a way to navigate the journey? And can I position myself for the destination? Which is the message that you hear us saying all the time, it is different this time around. It is ugly. It is very ugly. And it requires a retooling. It requires to ask the questions, am I still doing the right thing? Because this is not a reversion to the mean. This is something that we hardly ever see, which is a massive cyclical dislocation in the context of a massive secular realignment. And I leave you with the thought, before I get grilled by David, that there's nothing easy about a retooling. It is hard to design. It takes you out of your comfort zone. It's not automatic, and it's certainly not risk-free. But if you believe in anything I just said, the alternative of not doing it is even riskier. So let me stop here and have David ask whatever questions, then we're going to turn to your questions.
Feel-good event of 2009. The critics will not be calling
this, obviously. Thank you very much for having us. Muhammad was saying backstage how nervous he gets at these things. Clearly, you don't see that when he does it. Let's delve a little bit deeper into some of the things you were talking about and try and bring this a little more into the here and now before we talk about some of the ideas in the book, which you should all read because it is fascinating. Let's go right into the headlines. We have a nearly $800 billion stimulus package. Is it enough?
It's necessary but not sufficient. It's necessary because it addresses one of the four sectors that I mentioned that are contracting, which is the private sector, the consumer. It's not sufficient because unless you move on the other three, then once again, what seems like a very bold action will prove too little too late. I used to start my presentations by saying, imagine I had got up in front of you and told you a year ago that the following things would happen. What would you have thought of me? So I would say, imagine I would have told you that the government would own 80% of the biggest insurance company in the world, AIG. Imagine if I told you that the Secretary of the Treasury would appear in front of Congress and talk about the need to have a bazooka in his pocket. Right, and talk about unlimited appropriation. If I had told you that we would be having what I call the Sunday night specials, where everybody's waiting on a Sunday night to hear out of Washington, D.C., because people are terrified what will happen on Monday if there's no policy announcement. Most people would have said you're crazy, but that's what has happened. In fact, we've had some amazingly bold policy actions that have been too little too late. Why? Because we haven't yet addressed the simultaneity of the problem. So the Package is a necessary component of the solution, but it will only be effective if we move also on housing, on the banks, and if the rest of the world does the same thing. This is not no longer a U.S. issue. This is now a global issue.
We'll be taking your comments momentarily, so don't be shy when we get to that. The Dow fell another 250 points yesterday. All of us figured that we will never retire and our children will never go to college. A lot of the things that was spooking the herd on Wall Street was the notion of nationalizing the banks. Will we and should we?
You know, the N-word, as it's called, is very emotive. If you say somehow we're going to nationalize the banks, people get very, very emotive, and we could have a huge debate. So let me break it down into component. Is it likely that we will see increased government ownership and control of the banks? Because ultimately, what is nationalization? It's government ownership and government control. The answer is yes. Okay. Again, not because the government wants it, but because the government has to stabilize some systemically important institutions. The alternative is worse. And this talk about the government owning up to 40% of Citi is just a reflection that Citi needs to be stabilized. So are we going to see more ownership and control of some key institutions? The answer is yes. Then the question becomes, how far does this spread? Is it one or two institutions, or is it the whole banking system? For that, I don't have an answer. My hope is it's limited to one or two institutions. Otherwise, we really are changing our economic future in a major way. Because as much as there's market failure, there's something else called government failure. It is not easy to run institutions. And then the really tricky question is the burden sharing. Who should pay to get this problem fixed? And that is where the debate is going to shift pretty quickly. In our borrowing type, there's something called a capital structure in any company. The lowest part are the equity holders. They take the first loss, etc. So the banks, the equity holder, and already you see what has happened to the equity. The equity market has finally understood. We wonder as bond manager why it takes so long for the equity market to get what's going on. The equity market has finally understood how vulnerable the equity tranche is. And then at the top of the banks are the depositors. The depositors have understood that they're safe. That's why we don't see what we saw in September, around September 15th, which is people lining up outside banks to take their money out. People are comfortable with the safety of their deposit. But then there's everything in between. And the big debate, David, is going to be how is the burden shared by the different parts of the capital structure.
But at this point, it seems as though the Obama administration wants it both ways. We want to protect shareholders by not taking control, but we want to protect taxpayers by taking control. At some point, are they going to have to make the call?
Yes. You know, the government has been very clear. Hank Paulson said it back in August when they had to move on Freddie and Fannie. He said, we have three objectives. The first objective is we want to stabilize a systemically important institution. And provided we can agree on what is systemically important, I think we'd all agree that we need to stabilize it. The second is we want to normalize the functioning of the global economy and markets. And all of us can agree that you want to normalize the functioning of markets because over time, markets allocate resources much more efficiently than government does. Then the third issue is, like you say, we have to protect the taxpayer. The minute you insert we have to protect the taxpayer, which I as a taxpayer want that inserted, is the minute you say there are going to be losers and there are going to be winners, that I, the government, I'm going to choose the winners and the losers. And that's where you get paralyzed in your decision-making process.
We throw a lot of scary words like socialized medicine, socialized losses, and all that around. But in reality, it seems like it's damage control. What's wrong with the Swedish model, where we nationalize banks and then unnationalize banks?
The problem with the Swedish model is we have 7,000 banks. The Swedes had a handful of banks. In fact, most European countries have four or five banks. Our initial conditions are very different. Our initial conditions are 7,000 banks. So while the Swedish model looks good in terms of design, implementing it is very hard. People forget that there are four distinct stages to doing anything.
The first is recognition. You've got to recognize you've got to do something. And that doesn't come very, very easily. The second is design. And then people, once they get to design, they say, okay, that's it. But the reality is that's not where crisis management fails. Where crisis management fails is what comes next, which is implementation and effectiveness. And implementing a Swedish model is very, very difficult. There are too many banks to do that. So it's not something that you can go out and say, I'm going to do it. When you actually look and say, how am I going to do it, you get paralyzed. And that's what most policymakers have gotten paralyzed, which is that they look at the first best solutions, and they're very difficult to implement. So they find themselves in the world of third and fourth and fifth best, which is what you and I would call the muddle through. You just muddle along, hoping that things will get better. Right? And unfortunately, things have gotten worse, not better.
Obama yesterday convened a fiscal responsibility summit in Washington, and my first thought in watching it on television was, it's nice that they're talking about all these things. My second thought was, oh my God, look at all the problems. I mean, we're talking about the entitlement programs, we're talking about healthcare, we're talking about the war, we're talking about the budget, and on top of that, the worst economic conditions since the Depression. Is this just the towering inferno, or is this an opportunity for the United States?
It certainly is an opportunity because it allows you to deal with issues that you knew you were going to have to deal with, but you haven't. So the entitlement issue is something that's been out there for a long time. If you go back, people knew that starting from 2012, 2013 onwards, because of the demographics, that there was a major burden coming up, and the question is who was going to pay for it. And unless we started getting our act together today, it was going to get worse. So the good thing about a crisis, and I worked at the IMF for 15 years, and I tell you, I've seen crises make people take really difficult decisions that deep inside they knew they should have taken, but didn't. And so the good thing about a crisis is it forces you to confront problems. The bad thing is that if it's a really severe crisis like we have today, it is very difficult to have a coherent master plan. You end up making it up as you go along. Not because you're irresponsible, but because the phone rings at 3 a.m., to go back to the Hillary Clinton commercial, and says, you know, Bear Stearns is not going to be able to open tomorrow. The insurance companies are. So you get forced into this reaction mode. And that's the balance. That's the tug of war between, on the one hand, it's a massive opportunity. On the other hand, people don't have the ability to even take a breath. I'm pretty encouraged by what President Obama has done so far. Yesterday, for me, was first a recognition that you need an exit policy, that you need to start thinking today about how you're going to get out of these very large fiscal deficits. Second was a signal of a willingness of him to stand up in front of his biggest critics and debate them. Because ultimately, he's going to have to use his political goodwill to make very difficult decisions and take the country with him. So I was very encouraged by that. Thirdly, and this is the last thing that I've been encouraged with, is that while they've been criticized, while the new administration has been criticized for not sharing any good news, just like when you started saying this is not going to go down as you know, the most cheerful, the reality is that unless you understand where we are today, it's very difficult to get a road forward because we're going to have to do things that are pretty dramatic.
We're looking at a nearly $11 trillion national debt at the moment. By the time the administration gets us through this, we could be looking at a $15 trillion national debt. Your daughter's 5. My son is 7. What sort of world are they going to be looking at when they come of age?
They're going to be looking at a U.S. economy that grows less rapidly than it has in the past. So their ability to generate revenue is going to be less than what it has been. Most people think that the potential growth rate, the speed limit, the safe limit, if you like, to grow the economy, is probably going to go down from 3%+ to 2%+. Now, 1% may not sound much, but if you take it over time, it's a lot. So the first thing they're going to be inheriting is a economy that is subject to a much lower speed limit than before. The second thing they're going to be inheriting is a much higher debt. So at a time when revenues are lower, obligations are higher. So they're going to be squeezed both on the revenue side, on the expenditure side.
Higher taxes.
Higher taxes or higher inflation.
So or both.
Or both. You're very cheerful today.
Thank you. This is how I make a living.
And the third thing they're going to be inheriting is a risk to the downside, which is the risk of protectionism. Right, the risk that each country says, my problems are so large that part of solving them is by putting up barriers to trade, barriers to capital flows. And that's why every morning when I kiss her goodbye, I do think, wow, you know, what world is she inheriting?
Now, in the book, you talk a lot about transformation, and you take a very cup-is-half-full approach to it, talking about the emergence of China, the emergence of India, the sharing of power and leadership. I read the book, and I think, ooh, decline of the United States.
Yeah, it's not the decline of the United States in absolute terms, necessarily. Okay, there is no doubt that the share of the United States in wealth creation and growth is going down. In fact, the numbers are very clear, right? And if you look at history, that's what happens to most superpower at some point. There are handoffs. The question is not whether you get handoffs. The question is whether the whole pie continues to grow. So whether you and I, or more importantly, whether our kids are better off, is going to be a function not of the share of the U.S. as much as the size of the overall global pie. Now, the good news is that there is reason to be optimistic about the overall global pie as long as we can navigate these next few years. Because if you go to the parts of the world that are going through a massive transformation, there is a lot of productivity growth in there. Right? So the question is not to focus as much as the share as it is at the pie. That is difficult to do, okay? Because it's easier for us to think in relative terms. I sit on our partner compensation committee, and it's always striking when we sit with people and we give them their data for the year. They're very interested in, have I done better or worse in relative terms? And we keep on telling them, you don't pay your bills in relative terms. You pay your bill in absolute terms, right? But human nature is always to ask, how am I doing vis-a-vis you? So we have to resist this notion that we have to have a bigger part of a pie. We have to sort of think of how do we get the pie bigger. Right now what's happening is, of course, the global pie is contracting. When China stops consuming, that impacts people here.
So arguably China's success is our success.
Correct. This is a completely interdependent world. There is no way that we can do well if the rest of the world doesn't do well.
And yet protectionism still rules the day when it comes to policy.
Right.
How do you fight that?
By informing people, by holding forums such as this, by talking through the issues.
So we're solving it right now, is what you're saying.
You are. That's what you do. That's why you do NPR, right?
Let's open it up to questions at this point before the clock completely runs out. Right here. I'm sorry.
I was talking to a friend of mine in Germany, and the stimulus package that was passed recently was received very differently in England and Germany. There was a part that said, Buy American. And I saw President Obama talk about, well, yeah, but if we're going to stay with the WTO and all that, and so we're not going to really have trade wars. My German friend said, then say, why do you say Buy American at all? Because there was parades against the United States. Germany received it badly. What do you think he's thinking about when Geithner and Volcker have said, don't say Buy American?
Yeah, and that shows you the very delicate balance that has to be struck right now between getting enough people on board as to what President Obama has to do, and at the same time not making big mistakes. So the Buy American was put in the context of our international obligations, right? And you can focus either on the Buy American or you can focus on the context of our international obligations, right?
The Trade Department focused on the Buy American.
Correct, because there is a risk, a non-negligible risk that protectionism could really rise. And that is a risk that I think the policymakers understand, but increasingly it's not just about the policymakers, it's also about the politicians. Right.
And yet it seems like all the big picture people understand the self-defeating nature of protectionism in a global economy, and yet Buy American is put in words into the document.
Right, and you know, it's the reality that we are in a political system. The other concern, and I've been traveling around the world in the last few weeks, the other concern is an interesting one, which is that there isn't as much global coordination as you would expect given the global nature of the crisis. And the hope is that that is because we have a new administration that's still formulating its own policy, and it's very difficult to coordinate when you haven't completed your own homework. But there is also another fear, which is that the degree of global policy coordination that you need at this point is not occurring. We have a very important G20 summit coming up in London in about 6 weeks, and that's going to be a major test.
Some have talked about the need for mega regulators on a global basis. Is that even possible?
I think the notion of mega regulators is not possible. National jurisdictions rightly have enormous reluctance to give power to a multilateral. Right? It's very difficult for countries to cede power to a multilateral forum.
To the IMF, say.
To the IMF, to the World Bank, etc. So the mega regulator concept is one that in design looks really attractive. In implementation, is dead on arrival. More meaningful thing is to coordinate. So to set up principles, commonly agreed principle. Okay, I think of it as the 405 between here and where we live, which is, you know, you design the freeway and you design 7 lanes, and it's very clear which way the freeway is heading, but you don't tell people which lane you have to be in. You allow a certain amount of flexibility for those who want to drive slowly, those who want to drive less slowly, right? Okay, but and so what's critical is you need some agreed on principle that are globally coordinated, but implementation has to happen at the national level.
I can't help but be terrified of any solution that uses the 405 as an analogy.
It's better than the 5 this morning.
Now, you've talked about the regulatory pendulum swinging and swinging a bit too far into over-regulation. There's going to be a lot of people, especially civilians who don't work on Wall Street, who think that's not a bad thing.
Societies cannot accept and should not accept a system that privatizes massive gains and socializes massive losses. It's repulsive, right? And the banks haven't helped themselves by, you know, stories about the corporate jets and stories about, you know, the $35,000 piece of furniture, etc. So a society is going to go for a while with the right view that this should not happen again. So part of this should not happen again is to de-risk the banking system, to turn them into utilities so that they cannot do what they can. And part of the problem right now is that you have to save the financial system, not because the financial system as it exists deserves saving, but because the alternative is much worse. The financial system is like the oil in your car. If it breaks down, nothing else in your car works. You're going to be stuck in the middle of the 405 with massive traffic coming. Right? So you're going to cause harm to yourself, and you're going to cause harm, importantly, to the rest of society. And that is the trade-off, is that you have to save the banking system, but you have to do so while the rest of society says, you know, let them suffer. But they cannot suffer without hurting everybody else. And that is the political, minefield that President Obama has to face.
Question.
As a college instructor, you're talking about your young kids, but I'm dealing with young adults, and they really are afraid. And I'm wondering what you could share that I can share with them, how to prepare for this new future.
You know, it's scary because I talk to our summer interns and I talk to people that I know, and there's a lot of concern about people coming out of college as to what world they're going to come into. So I would first tell them that their concerns are warranted. I think people have to recognize that this is a difficult period. We're going to see the unemployment rate go up from here. It's awful, but that's the reality. Focus on the skill sets that you require going forward. And I think, being more international is a reality of the world we're going to live in. And just sort of talk them through. But I wish I had an easy answer. Okay, but this is a very difficult time. This is a crisis, I repeat, this is a crisis of the system. This is what people are going to be talking about in 20, 30 years' time. And some of us in this room, not me, because according to my doctor, I've put on too much weight, but some of us in this room are going to be able to say, yeah, I lived through those times. But I don't have, unfortunately, an easy answer. This is a very difficult time.
You used to manage the endowment at Harvard. I saw the other day that the total cost of attending Harvard for a single year is nearing $49,000. If we want to equip the future generations with the tools they need to deal with these problems, and yet we're pricing education out of the market, is that also a part of the self-defeating cycle that we're entering?
Yeah, I think the key thing about any educational institution is to be able to mobilize funds for financial aid. Okay.
Because there's all that extra cash floating around.
Well, it's there are people who can pay the 49, right? There are people who can pay the 49, and they should be paying the 49, okay? Because ultimately, that is the cost of educating someone. But it doesn't. What's important is to make sure that those who cannot pay the 49 have the ability to attend and go. So I tend to focus. I tend to think the energy should be on financial aid right now, which may mean spending less on buildings, may mean spending less on it, okay? But if the one thing that I would hate to see cut is financial aid.
Okay. Yes, I'd like to know what your...
One sec, the microphone's on its way. Special delivery.
what your expectations are, maybe over the next couple of years, for the commercial real estate CMBS market, what kind of fallout you might expect, especially as it relates to defaults and foreclosures?
There are a number of sectors, commercial real estate being one, high-yield companies being another, that grew up in a world where it was very easy to get debt, that people were not just willing to give those institutions a lot of debt, but also willing to do so at pretty low cost. As a result, a lot of companies and a lot of commercial real estate, and of course we see it in the housing market with subprime, etc., got into activities that they shouldn't really be in. These activities are not sustainable. Right? The first shoe to drop was residential. The next shoe to start that will drop is going to be commercial real estate and high yield. The market has already priced that in. The market has understood that when various projects, companies have to refinance, at best, they will refinance at much higher cost, but more likely they're not going to be able to fully refinance. So the market is pricing this there will be a spike in defaults. And that is why I said in the beginning, unfortunately, it is very difficult to see how 2009 does not involve rising unemployment. Get throughout the whole year. I'm trying to be cheerful, but it's
yeah, okay. You're making the effort, but
in the back right there.
If China and India if China and India sent stuff to America and the U.S. consumer consumed it, and that was the driving force of the last decade, if consumers in China and India now have to rise up and consume. What is the United States going to supply to them that will be part of our economy?
Jazz music, of course.
So the first critical element is to understand that we're coming from a world of vendor financing, Okay, it's no different than I walking into GM, buying a car, and then getting a loan from GMAC to buy the car. Okay, and everybody seems better off. GMAC has made a good loan, presumably. I'm driving a car, okay, et cetera. So we've coming from a world, like you say, where if you had to simplify it tremendously, the U.S. was consuming goods. They were produced by China, and China was providing the financing to the U.S. to consume the goods. So that was the vendor-financing relationship. The vendor-financing relationship depends on people consuming and people providing the finance. This part, people consuming, is breaking down. So the model itself, okay, is problematic. And the reason why this part is breaking down is because people overconsumed. And now it's very difficult to sustain the credit card bills, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, but here's the systemic problem. Consumer activity accounts for about 70% of the U.S. economy. In China, consumer consumption accounts for about 30% of the overall GDP. Clearly, the U.S. model is unsustainable, but how do we transition to something that is a more sustainable economy?
So over time, and here's the critical issue, over time, we transition to a global economy where consumption growth is provided by the middle class that is really coming on stream in China, India, and the numbers are so large that you can have a handoff in consumption. The problem is that that is an overtime concept, whereas the collapse in U.S. consumption is an immediate concept. So you have what economists call a time inconsistency, right? That these things are not coordinated. That is why the second largest fiscal package that's been announced is China. The Chinese recognize that part of their obligation is to try to accelerate that process of consumption increasing in the part of the world that is able to consume. The U.S. is willing to consume, but not able. China is able, but not willing, right? And that's what we have to realign on that. And that's why I go back to this notion of international coordination is so important, okay? And unfortunately, the mechanisms that we have for international coordination, like the G7 doesn't have China in it. Right? It's like, let's bring a club, and then ultimately the solution depends on someone that's not in the room. Okay, that's not going to work.
I'm sorry, the woman back here. One moment.
What about trying to innovate out of this and invest in utility-scale solar, more electric vehicles? I mean, the automotive sector has been an issue for decades. Unfortunately, oil prices, well, fortunately and unfortunately, they are where they are right now, which is hurting a lot of real businesses in Silicon Valley, a lot of job-creating industries. We used to lead in globally in financial services. We need to lead in other areas.
Totally agreed, and I would put that under the, let's hope the crisis allows us to move on things that we thought we knew were important but didn't seem urgent enough. I have a little chart that I learned when I was at the IMF. The IMF, like many other institutions, promotes you on the basis of technical merit and then finds that you end up in a managerial position with absolutely no management skills at all, right? So they had this solution of bringing in a management coach. So I would have this person who would come in once a week and sit with me for an hour and talk about what management issues I faced. And he would give me little techniques. And one of the techniques he gave me was this matrix, where one axis is how important is the issue, and the other axis is how urgent is it. And most people, most managers, are pretty good at focusing on what's urgent and important. And most managers are pretty good at recognizing what's not urgent and what's not important. The difference is in the other two quadrants. Bad managers focus on what's urgent but not important. It takes up a tremendous amount of time, but at the end of the day, it's not really that important. And really good managers focus on what's important but not urgent, because that's what's going to define long-term success. And the sorts of things that you've talked about have always been important but seemingly not urgent. The crisis makes them both important and urgent. And our hope and your hope of society is that we're going to grasp this opportunity, because we really now have a reason to move forward on them.
One more question. Thank you. How do you see the these trillion-dollar bailout bills being paid for? Do our lenders, China, mainly China and Japan, have the ability to continue to fund us at these levels? And how large or massive inflation do you see in front of us because of all this?
You've asked the two most critical questions that we debate almost every day in PIMCO's investment committee. Right. The first one is, and I'm gonna reformulate it if you don't mind. The U.S. provides two massive public goods to the rest of the world: a reserve currency. Our currency is accepted all over the world, and a financial system that is deep, predictable. Predictable is key. Okay, there's a notion that the rule of law applies in the United States, and that is liquid. These are two huge public goods. Because of that, the rest of the world is willing to hold more and more and more of our debt. But there's a limit, okay, to the extent to which you can abuse your public goods. It's not an immediate issue for the U.S., but over the next 5 years, if we don't turn things around, it will become an issue. So I worry less about the willingness of the rest of the world to hold our debt right now, provided we can get our act together. So that's there is a willing buyer because it's not easy to find an alternative. One thing that's striking everybody is the dollar is strengthening in the midst of a massive crisis. Why? Okay, because we still look better than the rest of the world, right? And the dollar is a relative price. So on the one hand, you know, it's an issue that has to be kept on the radar screen, but it's not as critical if the United States hadn't had these two public goods. The other issue is inflation. Ironically, if you were to be able to go inside of the mind of a policymaker and ask them today, what do you want? And they'll say, I want higher inflation provided stable. Inflation performs an important function, which is allows things to be reallocated in an easier manner. Today, the problem is we're having deflation around the world, which, of course, is putting tremendous pressure. For me, it is, again, unambiguous that if you had me back in 2 years' time, we'd be talking about inflation. The only question is, first, is it low and stable? And secondly, not what is inflation, what is the growth rate? But I think that if you look forward 2 years, inflation is part of the solution. The question is whether you can control it or not.
Well, we will definitely have you back in 2 years' time. But today, I'm afraid we've run out of time. Mohammed Al-Aryan.
Thank you, David. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
To adjourn us, please welcome Andy Knox from Korn Ferry.
Thank you. And to understate the obvious, we're both privileged and profoundly grateful for Mohammed taking the time to join us this morning. His comments are both timely, and as always, his ability to both distill and to communicate exceptionally complex and global issues in an understandable fashion is an enormous benefit to all of us. David, I'd suggest that we may try and persuade Mohammed to come back far earlier than 2 years. If I may, too, to wrap up, I'd like to thank you all for being here and for your support of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles on behalf of the sponsors of today's events, Wachovia and KPMG, Korn Ferry International, and Arnold and Porter. We appreciate it. Also, for those of you that don't know, the Library Foundation of Los Angeles is a nonprofit organization that was formed 17 years ago to support the activities of the library system, which is 71 branches across the city. And for many of you who have never set foot in a library or haven't set foot in a library in a long, long time in this city, the foundation provides the resources, whether it be technology, databases, programming, that wouldn't otherwise be available to the library system through city funding. So with that, we hope you'll come back and you can access this and other allowed performances programs through the website. Mohammed, David, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you all for attending.
Loud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. A Loud theme composed by Larry Karish.